Welcome back. We have IQ Al-Rasuli still on the line. We also have Glenn, having called in from Philadelphia. We'll be with Glenn in just a moment. IQ, I want to have listeners understand the full implications of what we talked about in that last segment. During the Meccan Surahs, Muhammad had a singular enemy, and it was Arabs, in fact, the Quraysh, his own neighbors, his own tribe in Arabia. And then in the 24 Medina surahs, he changed that enemy from Arabs to Jews. With the last two surahs revealed chronologically, after he had overhunted Jews, changing the enemy from Jews to Christians. Now, Muhammad led 75 terrorist raids during the first 10 years of the Islamic era, according to the Quran and Hadith. 70 of those raids were against fellow Arabs. This is not a man that Muslims ought to be trusting, is it?
Nobody should trust a Muslim who is a follower of Muhammad. By the way, I mean, we shouldn't just talk about it. Do you mind if I reveal to them, or our listeners, at least one verse to make them understand where we're coming from? Do you mind?
Oh, no, please.
The most disastrous of all the surahs of the Quran, Al-Tawbah, is one of the worst. Al-Tawbah is chapter 9. And chapter 9, verse 29, tells the followers of Muhammad the following. Fight, qatilu. That's fight to the death, by the way. Those who believe not in Allah, nor the last day, nor hold, that's forbidden, which has been forbidden by Allah and His Apostle Muhammad, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, Islam, even if they are of the people of the book. People of the book are Jews and Christians. Mm-hmm. Until they pay the jizya, which is an onerous tax for not being a Muslim, and they have to pay it with willing submission and feel themselves humiliated, just to make sure that the listeners would believe what I am revealing and what you are revealing. I would like to put forth a challenge worth $100,000 to the first person who can show us all one single operative verse in Muhammad's Quran that demonstrates any compassion and mercy towards unbelievers. Currently, ladies and gentlemen, unbelievers represent 80% of humanity. All Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, atheists, agnostics, etc. In a nutshell, all those who are not Muslims. So, $100,000 for just one verse from among over 6,200 verses in Muhammad's Quran. Back to you, sir.
Yeah. The sad situation here is that what you just read says that you must fight them to the death until everyone acknowledges Islam and Allah and Muhammad as the only religion that will be acceptable, the only God that can be known, the only prophet to speak on behalf of God, and you must fight them to the death until they either accept that or they surrender in absolute humility and fork over the vast preponderance of their wealth to the conquering Muslims. So under those circumstances, how is it possible that any concession to a Muslim to create an Islamic state, to arm Muslims, will end up in anything other than total and complete disaster?
Ask Kerry.
Yeah.
Ask Kerry. I don't know where he's coming from.
Right.
Al-Imran, chapter 3, verse 85, to reiterate, to prove what you just said, says, if anyone desires a religion other than Islam, submission to Allah, never will it be accepted of him. I mean, how much more does anybody need to come to the simple conclusion that Islam is intolerant, it's hate-mongering, war-mongering, misogynist, racist, vile, and is totally ungodly.
Yeah, and the problem with the things that you've just read is that the last two surahs of the Quran cannot be abrogated. The law of abrogation in the Quran says that when a verse contradicts, so if there were a peaceful verse, that the peaceful verse would be negated, contradicted, thrown into oblivion by the one that was revealed later. And there's only one surah that's revealed after the ninth, and that's the fifth. And the fifth is the surah that changes Allah's and Muslims' enemies from Jews to Christians. And it doesn't so much as make a transition to say, hey, we're no longer the enemy of the Jews. Now we're just the enemy of the Christians. It puts the Christians as front and center as the primary enemy, allowing Jews to remain an enemy.
So
when we have this this notion that we have a generation-long conflict between Arabs and Jews, that's completely dishonest. That the hatred between Muslims and Jews has began when Muhammad began revealing his Quran. It began in Yathrib, today's Medina. It is 1,400 years old, and it cannot be resolved so long as Islam exists.
Well, I would like to explain to them, our listeners, the following. In 57 Muslim majority states, with 1,500 million Muslims, the total number of Jews you might find in all of these Muslim countries might add up to maybe 20,000. 20,000 Jews among 1.5 billion. So the probability of any Muslim having ever met a Jew or dealt with a Jew is almost zero. Yet, Pakistanis hate Jews. They have no Jews there. Indonesians hate Jews. There are no Jews there. Bangladeshis hate Jews. There are no Jews there. Why do they hate Jews? Because the Quran says so.
Quran orders them to do so.
The token is exactly for the Christians.
Correct.
In Pakistan, in Bangladesh, in almost all the Muslim countries, even a small minority of Christians are being exterminated as we speak today. This is not against the Jews only, the Quran. It's not only against the Christians. It's against every human being who is not a Muslim. It is so important we assert this.
And it's a fight to the death, is it not? It's a fight to the death. It is a fight to the death, according to Allah and Islam.
It 1,400 years ago, yes. Muhammad declared it 1,400 years ago. He divided humanity into two parts. He said, if you are a jihadi Muslim, you will get in life the women of your that you conquered. You get the plunder of the countries you conquer. And if you die fighting in jihad, you get the 72 virgins in my whorehouse version of paradise. It's a win-win situation.
But unfortunately for the Muslim, it's a lose-lose situation because Allah's not God and Muhammad lied about everything. Glenn, you've been very patient, and I apologize for having you be on hold for so long. I know you had a comment on this subject.
Yes, hello, Yada. Hello, Hugh. How are you? I hate when people ask, how are you? I know. I just said it myself. It's so compulsive. I'd like to three quick points, two little sidelight things, and then the main issue. And I'd like to, like, rattle them off and let you guys comment. Number one, about the, you mentioned the dearth of Muslim cultural or economic contributions earlier. I was, you know, thinking that Arabs are to be, now this may be pre-Islam, but Arabs are certainly credited with some mathematical achievements. We use Arabic numerals, and the word algorithm derives from the name algorithm.
Let's talk about them one at a time here. The mathematical achievements that are attributed to Islam were both algebra and the conception of the letter zero are both from Hindu scholars. The Hindus were brutally in India, were brutally and savagely attacked and conquered by the Muslims, and the individuals who made those advances were Hindu slaves. What is called an Arabic number, an Arabic number is only called an Arabic number because most people do not know the history of the Arabic alphabet. When you know the history of the Arabic alphabet, you know that each of the digits that we call Arabic numbers now are absolutely, totally, and completely designed based upon their Hebrew counterparts. as the Hebrew alphabet developed, there is a pre-Arabic version of the and of the Hebrew alphabet, where the letters in order 1 through 9 are literally written the same way that we currently write the digits 1 through 9. So they aren't Arabic numerals; they're Hebrew numerals. They're in the same order as the Hebrew alphabet, and they're copies of those Hebrew letters. So there's the first two.
Okay, gotcha. Well, the next, and I don't want to dwell too much on this. In terms of Islam and Judaism cohabiting, people are also like to point out that that right now over 20,000 Jews are living peacefully in Iran without persecution.
You're right.
And that it, you know, you don't buy that.
No, go ahead, IQ.
Sorry. Listen, I come from Iraq. And in Iraq, we had 150,000 Jews whose ancestry belonged to the exile of the Babylonians 2,500 years ago, 1,100 years before Islam. Tell me, why are there no Jews now in Iraq? Why are there no Jews in North Africa? And the Jews of North Africa predated Islam by 1,100 years. So 20,000 Jews among 80 million Muslims, and they have freedom. They have no freedom.
Yeah, they have no freedom.
You cannot have freedom under Islam. Take that out of your equation.
Well, the story that's told is that they've even refused to, you know, make Aliyah and move to Israel, even though they're offered
they
money. Now, this
may
be
open.
Yeah, actually, when Israel
with
was...
With all due respect.
Okay, go ahead, Akid, and I have an answer. Go ahead.
With all due respect, if a Muslim, if an Arab goes from Egypt to visit Israel on a delegation, and they're crucifying them, what do you expect a Jew to say? That he would go to Aliyah? They will murder him before he leaves.
Yeah.
Look, Saddam Hussein, we used to have demonstrations supporting Saddam Hussein. Hundreds of thousands of people. They were trucked in. I am a witness. This is my country.
Yeah.
They were trucked in.
Yeah, they,
you know, when you have a power like Saddam Hussein, he tells you to move, you move. He tells you to lap, you know, bark like a dog, you bark like a dog.
Yeah, I will answer your question as well, Glenn, when Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Glenn, who is a frequent caller to this program, I asked IQ Arasuli about the alleged nature of 20,000 religious Jews existing peacefully inside of Iran, and how would he relate to that in terms of coexistence. There's some interesting history here. In 1948, there were 100,000 Jews living in Iran. They were living in Iran because the Northern Kingdom was hauled off in the 6th century BCE by the Assyrians. They were hauled off as slaves. And so 10 of the 11 Jewish tribes essentially ceased to exist with a national identity, if you will. They were hauled off as slaves by the Assyrians into what is now Iran. Then in the 5th century, BCE, Babylon, which had conquered Assyria by this point, conquered the kingdom of Yehuda, Judah, in the south, and it hauled away the remaining tribe of Jews into to Babylon. So there were a considerable number of Jews in Babylon. In 539 BCE, Cyrus ultimately and his descendants ultimately allowed some number of Jews to return to Yehuda. Now, here's some interesting numbers. As of 2012, there were 10,200 Jews in Iran. Now, a bit of history here is also interesting. during the time before Islam, while you still had a Persian state in the Middle East, in what is today Iran and Iraq, during the time of the Persian control before Islam, the Jewish population in Persia grew considerably, and it spread throughout the region. That's why there were Jews living in Yathrib and in Arabia. The Jews suffered intermittent oppression and persecution, but it wasn't until the invasion by the Arab Muslims in 642 CE that terminated the independence of Persia and installed Islam as the state religion, that the condition, the socio-political status of the Jews was changed, and changed negatively. Throughout the 19th century, Jews were persecuted and discriminated against in Iran. Sometimes whole communities were forced to convert or die. During the 19th century, there was a considerable immigration of Jews out of Iran to the land of Israel, and the Zionist movement spread throughout the community. Remember the Shah of Iran? Well, he was imposed by the American CIA, and when his dynasty was established, 1925, the country was secularized. And during this rise of secularism and orientation towards the West, the remaining Jews in Iran actually prospered. They were not only emancipated from being slaves prior to the secular state of the Shah, they played important roles in the economy and cultural life for a while. But then on the eve of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, 80,000 Jews who lived in Iran, most of them left. And not only did most of those 80,000 leave, according to the Islamic Revolution, they had to leave all of their wealth, all of their possessions, everything, all of their property behind. And it was confiscated by the Muslims. The official rule of Iran now is that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a Tsarist forgery, is the publishes the truth about Zionism and about Israel, and that now that Iran is been completely Islamicized again, there is no freedom for the Jews who live there. That's the truth.
But there is no freedom for the Jews, no freedom for the Hindus, no freedom for the Christians, no freedom for other sects of Islam.
Hey, IQ,
is no
how many...
freedom under Sharia.
IQ, can you tell me how many Christians were there in living in Iraq while there was a secular dictator, Saddam Hussein, in control of Iraq?
We had 1.3 million in 2003.
Okay, 1.3 million. So the United States goes in and deposes the secular dictator, Saddam Hussein, and establishes a Shiite government that is now managed by the Muslims in Tehran. How many Christians are there in Iraq?
Less than 200,000.
It's genocide, right? Annihilation.
It is genocide. Islam is genocide. I don't want to raise my voice. Yeah. But Islam
is genocidal.
Only through genocide.
We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. We have Glenn calling in as a guest, and IQ Arasuli is our expert in Islam. Glenn has mentioned two myths that have been promoted by Muslims to suggest that their religion is other than intolerant and genocidal, that their religion is other than moronic and destructive. And we have addressed those initial two. And by the way, addressing things like this, Muslim makes a lot of claims, like that there's a people called Palestinians in a place called Palestine. It is a lie. And unless we address the lies that are being made on behalf of Islam, then it is going to be difficult for people to understand what is going to happen to the world, how we are going to go into a world war. And so the more we can debunk myths on this program, the better people are prepared to understand where the world is headed. You said you had a third.
Right. Yes. On that note, last but certainly not least, this is the
yes.
One argument that is, you know, commonly made and is worthy of note and reputation relative to the Palestinian people's in that region is that even if one were to stipulate that the word Palestinian is a misnomer, that nonetheless in the centuries prior to the Balfour Declaration, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries, that there were nonetheless people, Arabic peoples, dwelling on the land with intergenerational continuity, there for living there for some time. In other words, the land wasn't empty, it wasn't a vacuum. There were long-established Arab tribes or peoples dwelling on that land for quite some time prior to the arrival of the Jews who ejected them.
And, okay. All right. Let me address that, and we'll get IQ's take as well. If you go back in the history of almost any land, but particularly this place, which the history is so well known, you originally had Canaanites and Jebusites and Hittites. They're all extinct peoples. They no longer exist. Yahweh brought his children, the descendants of Abraham, Yishak and Jacob. There we know them today as Israelites, and the land of as Israel. He brought his people into this place and gave it to them. They established a unified kingdom under Dode right around 1000 BCE. There are just enormous numbers of affirmations of that and throughout archaeology. Those people were then savaged in the Northern Kingdom by the Assyrians out of today's Iran, Iraq. They were then in the Southern Kingdom, they were savaged by the Babylonians. But they returned, particularly in the Southern Kingdom, to a province called Yehuda. After that time, Alexander the Great and his Greeks savaged them and conquered the place. They didn't really care about Israel or Yehuda. They were just trying to get to Egypt so they could rob Egypt. Then after the Romans beat the Greeks to a pulp and empowered themselves over the Greeks, the Romans laid claim to what is Yehuda, had a province of Yehuda, had Yehudim in the province of Yehuda, and so it was a Roman-controlled province of Jews. The Jews revolted twice against Roman oppression. They were the only people with the chutzpah, the courage to rebel against Rome, and did so twice, once in 70, once in 133 CE, and the Romans in 133 CE pummeled them with three legions. And that is when the country became essentially depopulated. Almost all of the Yehudim were hauled into European slavery, and the ground was salted.
Post-Maccabean period then?
No, the post-Maccabean period. The Maccabean period is the period of where the Greeks controlled Israel. Now, there's a period, the Maccabean period, where Israel lays claim to their land independent of the Greeks before the Romans come in. So I did miss that brief period. There is a brief period where that occurred. Now, at that point, it's still the province of Yehuda. The Romans decided to rename it Philistina, just to irritate the Jews who had the audacity to challenge their supremacy. Now, after that time, not all that long after that, Rome disintegrates. It gradually disintegrated over the next 300 years, and then there's really only one aspect of Rome left. It's the Byzantine kingdom. The Byzantines then took control over Israel. They still referred to it as Israel, but the Byzantines controlled it. Very few people lived there. The land wouldn't support a population because there's only Bedouins there. Salted land takes a very long time to recover. So during the time the Byzantines ruled over the land, then Muhammad creates Islam, and Muslims became barbarians, and the first Muslims then conquered the Byzantine Empire and came to control Israel. They really weren't interested so much in Israel, although they did want to defame Yahweh's Temple Mount with the Dome of the Rock. They were interested in conquering northern Africa and moving into to Europe. This was a crossroads, and they plundered everything in its place. Now, during that time, they referred to the place as Syria, which is Damascus, was where they had their capital. Damascus is interesting because, as we will soon hear, Yahweh had a lot to say about the fall of Damascus and how it leads to the last world war. From this period, then you have Arab Bedouins living in there, and you have even a fight between the Christians in Europe and in the Byzantine kingdom against the Muslims who were lording over the place, who had conquered the land of Israel, and the Muslim armies ultimately prevailed against the Christian armies, but the Muslim armies were almost universally comprised of those Arabs and Turks who lived outside of Israel, and very few of them ended up settling there. So it was a very small community, very small numbers of people there. When you have World War I and you have the British deciding that they could bribe and arm Muslims to fight against the Ottoman Turks, who were opposed to Britain in World War I, during that fight, what was all of the Middle East was ultimately divided between Jews and Muslims, with the Muslims getting 98% of it, the Jews getting about 2% of it, and the Jewish stake was going to be today's Israel and Jordan. The Muslims had a conniption fit and said the Jews can get nothing, and that's what kept Jews living in Europe, led to the Holocaust, and ultimately to the pronouncement of Israel as a state. There were very, very few Muslims who lived in Israel at that time. Now, you said that the Jews threw them out, and I know that's not the case. What happened was the Jews invited the Muslims who were living there, since there were so few of them, to remain. He said, "We'll be. You can be partakers in our new state. You can be citizens here. You can have all the rights and freedoms that we're going to offer to our people." And it was the Arab League Muslims who ordered the Arabs that were Muslims that were living inside of what was now Israel by declaration of the United Nations. They ordered them to leave so that the Islamic armies could fight more freely and push all of the Jews into the sea, killing every last one of them. So they were not expelled by the Jews. They were expelled by fellow Muslims. So that's the history of the place.
Ed, well, very good off the top, too. You sound like, I suspect you've done that before.
I do care a lot about Israel, and I care a lot about Islam, and I have a very different view of Israel than Islam. I have chosen to take God's perspective, Yahweh's perspective on both Israel and Islam. I think his perspective makes the most sense. It is the most historically accurate. It is the most moral. And so what I just shared with you is not only the history of these two, but it also is shaded by the perspective that Yahweh provides. And since he's God, and he's really smart, and he's been very effective at communicating with us, I've just decided, when I accept his perspective on things, I probably sound more sensible than if I take a different point of view.
May I put my two pence?
Yes, please, like you. Thank you for staying silent for me to go through all that time. By the way, did I say anything there that is inconsistent with what you know to be true?
Everything you said is absolutely true, because it's recorded history. You can't twist it. You can try to twist it, but you cannot twist it. You can try.
Yes.
What I would like our listeners to ask themselves is this. In 1947, the United Nations decided to divide only 22% of what was supposed to be by the Balfour Declaration given to the Jews.
Right.
Because what happened, the British mandate under Winston Churchill
right.
overruled their mandate. They gave the Jordan to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan.
Right.
They took out a huge trunk, 78%. They took it out from the Jews.
Right.
In 1947, the Jews said, okay, even half of the 22% we accept.
Right.
What did the Arabs do? They wanted to exterminate them. Who said so?
Right.
Read it. Azam Pasha, the head of the League of the Arabs, he said, the slaughter of the Jews will be greater than the slaughter of the Mongols. He was referring to what the Mongols did to Islam in the 11th century. Millions of Muslims were slaughtered by the Mongols.
Yeah.
So, what do we have here? There was a two-state solution in 1947. The Arabs
right.
refused.
Right.
Not Palestinians, the Arabs refused. Let us assume another one. For 19 years.
What I want you to do is hold on to that thought, because it's critical that people understand that the two-state solution that is being proposed now has been routinely rejected by the Muslims. It's just that they've lost every war to try to enforce their will. And now they want the world to capitulate, to give them what they could not win by war. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. IQ Al-Rasuli was discussing what the Muslims had to say that they wanted to do to the Jews who had come, who had survived the Holocaust, who had come back to Israel once it was declared a state. But before you continue with that, IQ, I would like to add something that I should have said. And that is, prior to 1948, between the two world wars, the population that existed in Israel was fairly evenly divided amongst four groups of people. The four groups of people were Arab Muslims, religious Jews, Arabic Christians, or Arab Christians, and Bedouins who really had no religion at all, just were living an ancient lifestyle. Those four groups represented about 25% each of the population of Israel. And after Muslims were given the control over their territory and the Palestinian Authority agreements, the percentage of Christian Arabs has gone from 25% down to less than 1%. So that's a little more insight. Go ahead, IQ. You were talking about the mindset of the Muslims relative to the Jews once Israel was declared a country.
Let me tell you something else. What Muslims and Arabs will never tell you in reality. The Balfour Declaration of 1917 regarding the return of the Jews from the diaspora to the land of their birth also asserted the creation of what later became 22 Arab states that did not exist. Iraq
Correct.
Did not exist.
Correct.
Kuwait did not exist. Saudi Arabia did not exist. Lebanon did not exist.
Correct.
Jordan did not exist. None of them existed.
Syria did not exist. Correct.
None.
So the Muslims accepted all of the land. Right.
And given
all
to the Arabs, and
right.
the Arabs would deny the Jews even a slice of 8,000 square miles.
Correct. And so not only are they dependent upon the Balfour Declaration for their own existence as states, they reject that part of the agreement to give the Jews a small sliver of the land. And then in 1948, when the two-state solution was offered, the Muslims rejected it. So now to say they want to go back to the 242, UN Resolution 242 borders, that agreement is to say, wait a minute, we would not accept that agreement. We fought three wars to try to annihilate the Jews. We lost all three wars, and now that we've lost all three wars because we didn't accept the agreement, we want you to impose that agreement on the Jews. It is absolute and complete insanity.
Correct. Most important of all, Glenn, if you think, for 19 years between 1948 and 1967, there were no Jews in the West Bank and Gaza. There were no so-called settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Gaza was conquered by the Egyptians and occupied it, and the West Bank was conquered by the Jordanians and they occupied it. And for 19 years, not a pipsqueak from the United Nations talking about occupied territories, nothing from the Western countries about occupied territories, nothing from America about occupied territories, and nothing from the Palestinians, so-called, about occupied territories. The only time people started getting hot under their pants is when the Israelis won the war in self-defense in 1967.
Yes.
Question. Why for 19 years there wasn't a single resolution in the United Nations, by Europe, by America, and by the Arab League regarding the occupation of Palestinian lands by the Egyptians in Gaza and the Hashemite Kingdom in Jordan? Question. Why not? Why didn't they do that? Why all of a sudden they want a Palestinian state?
They have a Palestinian state. It's called Jordan. You know,
yes.
That's three quarters of the population would identify themselves with the Arab Muslim tribes that lay claim to Israel. There is a Palestinian state. And what happened to these so-called mythical people known as the Palestinians in Syria? Didn't Assad's father annihilate them?
They are annihilating them as we speak today. They got rid of them in Jordan. They got rid of them in Iraq. They got rid of them in the Yemen. They got rid of them in Saudi Arabia. They got rid of them in every country because they are disloyal to every single country.
That is correct. The people who want to be known as Palestinians, these Arab Muslims living in Israel, are despised by every Islamic country around the world. No one wants anything to do with them in an Islamic country. They're only touted because they are a tool to wield at the hated enemy, the Jews.